Welcome to the world today. My name is Frank Weltner. I am the librarian for JewWatch, the largest compendium of information about Jewish organizations and news on the internet today. In addition, I am the librarian and archivist for a new website, www.americanussr.com, which is already the largest compendium of history concerning the negative aspects of the United States of America, which the CIA, FBI, the presidency, the Congress, and all other agencies of the United States want you to know nothing about. Today is December the 24th, 2010. It is a snowy, blustery Christmas Eve in St. Louis. The children are all bundled up in their homes, excited to see what Santa Claus is going to bring them. But I'm sitting here in my radio studio, speaking to you, to tell you that what Santa has in store for you, now and in the near future, may not be particularly what you wish for. But you can never tell. If you're a sick enough person, maybe it will suit you just fine. If not, oh well. Well, today a story surfaced that a judge called for the prosecution of three Swiss engineers. They're suspected of smuggling nuclear weapons technology, following allegations that the United States pressured Switzerland to destroy incriminating evidence to conceal their work for the CIA. Now, where have we heard this before? Don't we hear this almost every day, that there's a story surfacing where people have worked for the CIA, not necessarily with nuclear weapons, but with weapons of all types? But a lot of these things do have to do with nuclear weapons. Swiss federal magistrate Andreas Müller made his recommendations to bring these three to trial at the end of a six-year investigation into the activities of engineers Urs Tinner, his brother Marco, and their father Friedrich, who were arrested in 2004 on suspicion of smuggling but later released. They said they had worked for the CIA since 2003 as informers. The three were suspected of supplying technology to a nuclear smuggling ring in Pakistan run by Abdul Qadir Khan, a nuclear scientist reputed to be the father of Pakistan's atomic bomb. Mr. Khan, who now lives under government surveillance in Pakistan, is suspected of having aided Iran, Libya, and North Korea with uranium enrichment programs. The Tinners are alleged to have played a bizarre dual role as nuclear weapons smugglers, who at the same time worked for the CIA as informers and banked on the agency's protection. There are many parts, Mr. Müller said yesterday. It's like a puzzle, and if you put the pieces together, you get the whole picture. Well, that's what I'm here for, is to put these pieces together and to try to get the whole picture. We do this every evening, practically, just to see what might appear. So let's see what we can put together here to get the whole picture from this story. Is there enough information here to say something about it? The Tinners claim to have helped supply the CIA with information about nuclear projects in Libya. They also admit to working for the Khan network, and according to independent U.S. reports, they supplied the CIA with key information about its activities. But they claim not to have known that Mr. Khan's aim was to produce nuclear weapons, and they deny having supplied him with the relevant technology. Allegations that the U.S. had pressured Switzerland to bury the case against the Tinners surfaced in 2008 after the Swiss government ordered 100 pages of evidence against them to be shredded. Copies of the documents have since reappeared. So here we have these three gentlemen, two brothers and a father, who have given some sort of nuclear information or materials to Pakistan and to Libya, and they're wanted for smuggling by the Swiss government, smuggling nuclear weapons technology. They claim to have been working with the CIA. The CIA itself has, on many occasions, helped in the dissemination of nuclear technology. How do you think Israel was able to get so much nuclear technology? Of course, a lot of the people who are involved in nuclear technology are Jewish people from New York, the same ones that gave information to the Soviet Union about how to make an atomic bomb, as well as a hydrogen bomb. Of course, the CIA is also riddled with Jewish people. It's been penetrated, as has the FBI, by just literally hundreds of Jewish people who not only report to Israel on the goings-on in the CIA and in the FBI, but they're also paid to do that. And the United States has been penetrated so much by these Israeli agents that it's very difficult to find out how you could expect any secrets to be kept in the United States. Because every secret is basically transported immediately to Israel, where it's analyzed, filed, and put into computers for use now and later, sometimes for blackmail. So here we have these three people named Mueller, who are Swiss. I suppose they're Swiss engineers, what it says here, so I suppose they are Swiss. And they have incriminating evidence that has concealed their work for the CIA. So what do you think Switzerland would be doing in terms of prosecuting them? Prosecuting them for smuggling nuclear weapons technology, which they allegedly were reporting about to the CIA. And you have to ask yourself, well, why would they want to prosecute these people? First of all, the CIA doesn't want them to. Secondly, all they have to do is to claim that they work for the CIA and they were doing this for the CIA. So you have to ask yourself, how in the world would they be able to do anything in Switzerland that would put these people in jail? Because they have the perfect cover, having worked for the CIA. Now, admittedly, the CIA is very, very unpopular around the world. So the people who admit they work for the CIA are basically known as some of the biggest lowlifes in the universe, because the CIA has come up with things like MK Ultra, where poisons were injected in people to see what would happen to them, where people were actually murdered to see whether they would confess toward the end of their torture. I mean, we're talking about some really nasty people here in the CIA, which is probably why all the presidents of the United States visit Langley and thank the CIA for the wonderful job they're doing. It's almost as though they're asking them, please don't torture me, torture someone else. I'll talk about what a wonderful job you're doing, as long as you don't do it to me. At any rate, we have three people here who are going to be prosecuted. But if I were you, I wouldn't hold my breath. I don't think they're going to be prosecuted. I think a signal's being sent to the United States by Switzerland here that if the United States doesn't help Switzerland by laying off of the pressures the United States has put on Switzerland for other things, such as allowing them to look into banking records, etc., that they're going to bring these Muellers up and expose a lot of the secrets of the CIA, which the CIA doesn't want them to expose. It looks to me like it's both of these are black flag operations. You have these three that were working for the CIA as a kind of black flag operation, and now the nation of Switzerland is using a black flag op against the CIA, saying, we'll dangle these people if you don't play along with us. We will expose you for what you've done and how you, the United States, have been instrumental in shipping this technology to Pakistan using these Swiss engineers as your go-boys. Anyway, that's going to be sort of interesting. It's a crazy story. It's crazy because there isn't enough information here to really see exactly what's going on. So what it is a leak of some sort, of something that's far more important than this, and we'll have to keep our eye on this to see exactly what's going to transpire here. But for the CIA to be working with people, giving them a cover for passing nuclear secrets to Pakistan, just at the time that the United States is working with Pakistan and Pakistan has developed its first nuclear weapons, it's a pretty spicy and a pretty dicey little story. And we're definitely going to keep an eye on this one as it develops. I am looking at photographs of some very handsome young men. In a story that calls itself, by headline, Hitler's Christmas Party. And it claims that these are Hitler's henchmen and that they're not very happy at their Christmas party because, possibly because they weren't able to take Moscow and to complete their romp into the Soviet Union. But I look at the pictures of the faces, and these look like very clean-cut young men, ideologues, idealists, people of innocent intent who were nationalists for their own country. At this time, there was no indication of any Holocaust or anything like this going on. And yet, we find that this story calls these pictures of Hitler and his henchmen, a party for SS officer cadets in Munich, etc., etc., etc. And then it points out that Hitler believed that religion had no place in his 1,000-year Reich, so he replaced the Christian figure of St. Nicholas with the Norse god Odin and urged Germans to celebrate the season as a holiday of the winter solstice rather than Christmas. Well, the slings and insults toward Germany and toward the Nazis has never ended. It's something that you just come to expect. There's no sense of objectivity in covering these stories, only a kind of hateful essence by the press, which is owned basically by the Judeo-Bolsheviks, whom Hitler was trying to disgorge from Russia after they'd killed 65 million people there. And Germany was next, and they had tried to take over Germany, these Judeo-Bolsheviks. Hitler stopped them and then invaded Russia, hoping that England would come in with him. But England refused to, so he was fighting them alone, and he lost. And a result of his loss, the United States suffered a Cold War lasting almost 50 years, costing us trillions of dollars, destroying our Constitution as we gave up one freedom after another in order to fight this false war with the Soviet Union that Hitler was going to fight for us, but we wouldn't work with him, so we ended up having to do it. But the really interesting thing about it was during that 50 years, Russia never attacked the United States, and the United States never attacked Russia. And even when the Hungarians revolted and were winning, and they were about to pull Hungary out of the Soviet orb, when the Russians went in, they evidently got a signal from Eisenhower that, why don't you go in and get them? Because, you see, Eisenhower was in on the shtick. The shtick was that the Russians were going to take their little SOBs in the Eastern Bloc and make them hate the United States, lying to them and telling them the United States was going to kill them if they didn't line up with Russia to protect themselves. Because the United States had hydrogen bombs, and Russia had them too, and Russia could protect them. Meanwhile, in the United States, the newspapers here are telling people here that, well, we have to line up with the Western Bloc, Germany, France, etc., Italy, to protect ourselves from the gross Soviet Union that might kill us with their weapons, because the Soviet Union wants to take over the world. So we had both sides claiming the other side was trying to take over the world, which is just another one of these American and Russian lies that were circling around during these times. Oh, there were lies during the revolution, the Red Revolution, where people were lied to and told that if you get rid of the Tsar, you're going to have freedoms here in Russia that will never be matched. And the Jews went to the German front and undermined the Russian troops, telling them, "Come, put your weapons down. Let's march toward Moscow, defeat the government, and get out of this war." And so all these backbiting things were going on. And the CIA was in on it, what the CIA was at the time. We were in charge of a lot of this. In fact, we were able to see to it that that Lenin got passed through to Petrograd in a covered car on a train, where he could start the Red Revolution, which is evidently what the Jews in New York wanted, because this was going to be a Jewish revolution. And it was. Trotsky was from New York. He was Jewish. He ran the Red Army, Red Commissars. Stalin was married to three Jewish women. Everybody associated with this was Jewish. But you never heard it in the Jewish-owned American newspapers here in America. It was always kept kind of hush-hush. As a matter of fact, there was a scandal with Walter Duranty, who went to Russia to report on Stalin, and he gave a glowing report in 1933 about how wonderful Stalin was and how he had move the Russians forward and democratized it, made it more free. And he knew that there was all sorts of slaughter going on in the Ukraine and elsewhere in the East. Of course, for Russia, it was the West. And that they were slaughtering millions of Ukrainians, millions of Belarusians. And Durante knew this, but he didn't report it. Now, because of these glowing reports of Stalin, it helped the United States to unite with Stalin to defeat Hitler. But at this time, a lot of people wanted us to unite with Hitler to defeat Stalin, because Stalin was the one that was killing people, and Hitler hadn't killed anybody. He had simply stopped communism in Germany. But Durante was Jewish, Walter Durante, and he won the Pulitzer for this magnificent reporting, which left out all the important details that America should have known about the murders that were going on, about the Holocaust against the Ukrainians, the Holocaust against the Belarusians, the Holocaust against the people of Petrograd and the intellectuals, and the Holocaust against the Catholic Church, especially the Russian Catholic Church, the Orthodox Catholic Church, and how beautiful structures were being burnt to the ground because they were Catholic cathedrals and basilicas, such as the huge St. Catherine's Basilica, which was burnt down by one of the evil Jews in charge of Russia by the name of General Kaganovich, who remarked after he had burnt down St. Catherine's, this beautiful stone structure, that now the skirts of Mother Russia have been revealed and torn away. So here you have this story about this these henchmen of Hitler. All they wanted to do was to rid the world of the Judeo-Bolsheviks, who have taken over America now in the American USSR, and in the Russian USSR, had taken over that country and begun slaughtering everyone, destroying all freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, all freedoms being choked to death by these people. But we didn't want to help Germany to rid the world of the dangers of Joseph Stalin. And the reason we didn't was that the banks here in America run the entire show, and the banks are run by Jewish people. And Stalin was Jewish. Lenin was Jewish. He grew up speaking Yiddish. Trotsky was not only Jewish, but lived in New York for 3 years and worked in Jewish theater and Jewish movies, and starred in 3 movies. In one of them, he actually starred as a Russian activist. So here you have this situation in which we are still blaming the Germans for us having supported the great murderer Stalin, who murdered far more people than the Germans ever murdered. And remember, the Germans were under a lot of pressure. The Jewish socialist parties in Germany were rioting in the streets and had been for 20 years. That's how Hitler came to power. The people just had enough of the chaos that was being fomented by these radicals. And so they put an end to it. Now, I'm not going to say anything about the Holocaust. I'm just telling you why Germany did what it did. It was under a lot of pressure from a lot of communists who happened to be Jewish, just like the United States in the 30s was under a lot of pressure by the communists in New York who were Jewish and who ran our banks and who destroyed our economy in 1929 and 1933. An economy that never came back fully to what it was in 1933 until 1956, when the stocks on the market finally reached the same point they had been in 1933. And now we have these same suspects, these Judeo-Bolsheviks in New York, in Goldman Sachs and other banks up there, Bank of America, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, usual suspects. They have destroyed our economy again. They've lied to us and said, give us trillions of dollars and we will stop the foreclosure crisis. We will work with these people. Well, we gave them the trillions of dollars and they didn't stop the foreclosure crisis. They continued to foreclose on one home after another, and they haven't been helpful at all. All they did was deplete our nation of trillions of dollars in the greatest heist by these Judeo-Bolsheviks in the history of mankind. And did we arrest them for doing it? Of course not. This is America, where the Judeo-Bolsheviks reign free in a place called Wall Street, Madison Avenue, in the great giant media operations such as NBC, ABC, CBS, Murdoch's Fox, all these people littered with Judeo-Bolsheviks as writers, as directors, as producers, so that everything that you see and hear, my friends, is created for you by the Judeo-Bolsheviks who wish to destroy you and are doing so rather quickly. These same enriched Jews who were able to destroy Mother Russia, to kill the Christian Tsar there, to kill him and his wife, his daughters and his son, all of them innocent children, who murdered him and murdered his children and then hid them in a forest with no funeral, no rites that most of us take for granted in the midst of death. There was nothing, just complete humiliation for them. These Judeo-Bolsheviks have no respect for any person in Western civilization. They have done their best to destroy all of the monarchies in the world that were Christian, because they've always had at the center of their hearts the desire to run all of these nations. And the monarchies were Christian monarchies. They were run by divine decree, wearing a crown with a cross on it that bespoke Christianity, and how they were there as the heads of state, as the monarchs, to rule with the right arm of God and to protect God's children from the evil ones, who, of course, were the Judeo-Bolsheviks, who Jesus Christ said in the parable of the tares of wheat, they had penetrated his church and all of them should be destroyed. The tares of wheat myth, if you're not familiar with it, was a myth that there was a field that was created by a good man, and the good man came to the field and planted seeds that were good. And the evil one came, and as these good seeds were germinating and growing, he threw bad seeds into the field. And the disciples asked Jesus, well, what is this field? And Jesus said, the field is my church. The good wheat that was thrown there by seeds from the good man are my Christian people, my followers, and I was the good man who planted them inside my church. But the evil one was the devil, and he represents the Jewish people who have penetrated my church with the idea of spying upon us and spying upon you, and then to turn you over to the Sanhedrin, where you can be arrested and even killed. They said, what then should we do? And Jesus said, wait until the wheat is mature and can be harvested, and then harvest it. Then burn the rest of the field to the ground. Now, some people have said that this was Jesus Christ foreseeing the Holocaust, where the Jews were evidently burned out. I won't comment one way or the other on it. But that's what the Bible says, and that's what it says that Jesus said. But for some reason in our modern civilization, even though Christianity was very cognizant of the fact that the Jews were out to get the Christians all throughout history, whenever St. Paul would go to a Roman city and preach, the Jews would ask the governor of that city to remove him and to chase him away. This happened constantly. They plotted to kill him. They plotted to kill him, and he had to grasp the legs of Festus, the governor of Judea in Caesarea, to save himself. He was then transported to Rome and almost died in a shipwreck at sea on the island of Malta. And then he was finally, after the Jews continued to persecute him in Rome, where they were quite powerful financially, he was finally killed. These people don't love you if you're in the Western world and you're a Christian. They only love their own kind. This is why they have placed themselves in charge of the newspaper, so that they can propagandize you and make sure that you never hear anything about them that's bad. You have to ask yourself, how in the world could these Judeo-Bolsheviks run almost all of our newspapers, TV stations, our movie theaters, etc.? It's because they run the banks. They're able to get money for free, to use it to buy everything up, and then to charge you and me interest for it if we want to buy anything back. And since we have to pay the interest, we can never get ahead, and so they continue to rule us by this deceit. These are the same people that ruled us in Israel at the time of Christ, where this was talked about, and in Rome, and in France, and in England. The Rothschild banks literally robbed England of its non-Jewish capitalists who owned all of their industries. But Rothschild, who had carrier pigeons, created a plot whereby he followed Napoleon to Waterloo, and he knew from the carrier pigeons that came straight to him through the air that the British had won a brilliant victory. But the Rothschilds owned all the newspapers in Britain, and they reported that the British forces had been routed and that Napoleon was going throughout Europe burning all of the major cities. And there was a total panic on the stock market in England, in London. The people sold their stocks for 10 cents on the dollar. At which point Mr. Rothschild, who ran the banks and who had done this plot, stood up and said, well, I'll be good and I'll try to stabilize the market by buying these things. And he bought them at the bottom. He bought every stock that was on sale at the bottom for 10 cents on the dollar. And the next day, when the ships arrived across the channel and the telegraphs began to report the real news that it was a total victory for the British, well, Mr. Rothschild already owned all of British industry for 10 cents on the dollar. And he was not the type of person who would give it back. Nor were the king and queen the type of people who would make him give it back. Since in order to pay for these Napoleonic wars, they'd had to borrow heavily through these banks. And they had promised them half the world. So they weren't going to do anything. So now the revolution was complete. And the Judeo-Bolsheviks of England owned just about everything. And it was about that time that Rothschild paid the inevitable Jewish individual by the name of Karl Marx lots of money to write Das Kapital and begin the march of communism throughout the world as a movement, so that now The Judeo-Bolsheviks not only ran communism and even wrote the book, but they also ran capitalism. So they had the entire world in a wedge between left and right, so that everything that was being spoken was owned by these traitors to all of these countries, people who worshipped only money and banks and military objects and corruption and deceit. And they were able to keep all of this in line by owning the newspapers and reporting only what they wanted to have reported. So that the United States today doesn't even know what's going on unless they listen to Frank Welter. You have to listen to me to find out what's going on. And that's a pretty sorry state of affairs, considering there's 300 million people in this country. And the Jews, whenever they reached a high state of employment in America's a Department of Justice, such as Mr. Mukasey and Chertoff with the Homeland Security, they came after me and tried to shut down Jewwatch News because they considered it so detrimental to their cause, which was the cause of American destruction, the cause of sending our industry out to China, of sending our money to the banks, of making Israel our best so-called friend when it has nothing to offer us but harm and hurt, and using this to make the rest of the world hate us, so that when the time comes to push us over and to totally destroy us, it will be easy. This has been their plan all along, and it's been printed and written up throughout the ages. You could find all sorts of writings on it on the internet, especially the Protocols of Zion, which are 400 years old. I realize that the Jews have tried to lie and say, well, it was done by Russian agents, but no, it's been around a long, long time. They tried to say, well, it was part of it was in a play in France, in Paris, in the 1860s, and it was copied from that. No, the Protocols of Zion are quite long. You couldn't possibly produce a play with the entire Protocols of Zion in it. That's just another Jewish lie to keep people from understanding the truth, which is that these people have planned to take over this world. They've planned the New World Order, and the banks and the bankers are the New World Order of this world. And every time there's a world war, they make a fortune because they loan the money to all of the governments of the world to pay for their weapons and armaments. They own the companies that produce the armaments, and they make a killing off of it, so to speak. That's a pretty bad pun for a world war, to make a killing off of it, but they do. They make tons of money off of these wars. These wars are about profit. They're about bolstering the Judeo-Bolshevik banking system, which is sucking the blood and the energy away from all of the working people of this world, so that it goes to these folks who have planned to rule this world from a central government and to cause the rest of us to lose every freedom that we ever fought for and died for. And that's basically the truth of the matter. The Jews have constantly murdered the kings and queens of Europe, because Jews cannot be a king or a queen. And so in order to rule the world, they have to rid themselves of this world of the kings and queens who are ruling in the stead of Jesus Christ, wearing a crown with a cross on the top. Now, let's see what these wonderful Jewish people, who tell you how wonderful they are in their newspapers, here's what they did to the Christian ruler of Russia. This is written by Mark Weber. It says, in the night of July the 16th to the 17th in 1918, a squad of Bolshevik secret police, Jews in other words, a squad of Bolshevik secret police murdered Russia's last emperor, Tsar Nicholas II, along with his wife, Tsaritsa Alexandra, their 14-year-old son, Tsarevich Alexis, and their four daughters. They were cut down in a hail of gunfire in a half-cellar room of the house in Ekaterinburg, a city in the Ural Mountain region, where they were being held prisoner. The daughters were finished off with bayonets. To prevent a cult for the dead Tsar, the bodies were carried away to the countryside and hastily buried in a secret grave. Jewish Bolshevik authorities at first reported that the Romanov emperor had been shot after the discovery of a plot to liberate him. For some time, the deaths of the empress and the children were kept secret. Soviet historians claimed for many years that local Bolsheviks had acted on their own in carrying out the killings, that Lenin, the Jewish founder of the Soviet state, had nothing to do with the crime. In 1919, Moscow playwright and historian Edvard Radzinsky announced the result of his detailed investigation into the murders. He unearthed the reminiscences of Lenin's bodyguard, Alexei Akimov, who recounted how he personally delivered Lenin's execution order to the telegraph office. The telegram was also signed by Soviet government Jewish chief Yakov Sverdlov. Akimov had saved the original telegraph tape as a record of the secret order. Radzinsky's research confirmed that earlier evidence had already indicated that it was true that this had happened. Leon Trotsky, one of Lenin's closest colleagues, had revealed years earlier that Lenin and Sverdlov had together made the decision to put the Tsar and his family to death. So here we had the Jewish Trotsky, the Jewish Lenin, and the Jewish Sverdlov, the president of the Soviet Union, killing the Christian Tsar and his family, his innocent children, his innocent wife. And the Tsar himself was quite innocent, too, as a matter of fact. Recalling a conversation in 1918, the Jewish Bolshevik Trotsky wrote, "My next visit to Moscow took place after the temporary fall of Ekaterinburg to anti-communist forces. Speaking with the Jewish Sverdlov, president of the Soviet Union, I asked in passing, 'Oh yes, and where is the Tsar?' 'Finished,' he replied, 'he has been shot.' 'And where is the family?' 'The family along with him.' 'All of them?' I asked, apparently with a trace of surprise. 'All of them,' replied the Jewish president Sverdlov of the Soviet Union. 'What about it?' He was waiting to see my reaction, and I made no reply. 'And who made the decision?' I asked. 'We decided it here. Ilyich Lenin believed that we shouldn't leave the whites a live banner to rally around, especially under the present difficult circumstances.' I asked no further questions and considered the matter closed." Recent research and investigation by Radzinsky and others also corroborates the account provided years earlier by Robert Wilton, correspondent to the London Times in Russia for 17 years. His account, which is printed in The Last Days of the Romanovs, originally published in 1920, and recently reissued by the Institute for Historical Review, is based in large part on the findings of a detailed investigation carried out in 1919 by Nikolai Sokolov under the authority of white anti-communist leader Alexander Kolchak. Wilton's book remains one of the most accurate and complete accounts of the murder of Russia's imperial Christian family. A solid understanding of history has long been the best guide to comprehending the present and anticipating the future. Accordingly, most people are interested most in historical questions during times of crisis, when the future seems most uncertain. With the collapse of communist rule in the Soviet Union, 1989 to 1991, and as Russians struggled to build a new world order, a new order in Russia from the ruins of the old, historical issues have become very topical. For example, many ask, how did the Jewish Bolsheviks, a small movement guided by the teachings of German Jewish social philosopher Karl Marx, succeed in taking control of Russia and imposing a cruel and despotic regime on its people? I mean, you have to remember that the Jews were less than 0.5% of Russia, and they had been freed only 70 years before by Alexander II, whom the Jews then killed in an assassination plot. The moment they got their freedom, they killed the czar who gave them their freedom. And so what happened was that since we're only one half of 1%, they were so few that as soon as anyone rose their head up to talk about against anything the Jews were doing in the Soviet Union, they killed them. They just killed them because there were so few Jews that they had to kill everyone who stuck his head above the grass where they could be seen. And they killed them one after the other until 65 million people were dead and the Jews were still in control. In recent years, Jews around the world have been voicing anxious concern over a specter of anti-Semitism in the lands of the former Soviet Union. In this new and uncertain era, we are told, suppressed feelings of hatred and rage against the Jews who ran the Soviet Union once again are being expressed. According to one public opinion survey conducted in 1991, for example, most Russians wanted all Jews to leave the country. But precisely why is this anti-Jewish sentiment so widespread among the people of the former Soviet Union? Why do so many Russians, Ukrainians, Lithuanians, and others blame the Jews for so much misfortune? Although officially Jews have never made up more than 5% of the country's total population, they played a highly disproportionate and probably decisive role in the infant Bolshevik regime, effectively dominating the Soviet government during its early years. Soviet historians, along with most of their colleagues in the West, for decades, preferred to ignore the subject. The real facts, though, cannot be denied. With the notable exception of Lenin, Vladimir Ulyanov, who himself is suspected to be Jewish since he was raised in a Yiddish-speaking family, and most of his friends were Jewish, and especially his political friends, most of the leading communists who took control of Russia in 1917 to 1920 were Jews. Leon Trotsky, Lev Bronstein, headed the Red Army and for a time was chief of Soviet foreign affairs. Yakov Sverdlov was both in the Bolshevik Party's executive secretarial position and chairman of the Central Executive Committee. Head of the Soviet government, in other words. Grigory Zinoviev headed the Communist International, Comintern, the central agency for spreading revolution in foreign countries. Other prominent Jews included press commissar Karl Radek, whose real name was Sobelson, foreign affairs commissar Maxim Litvinov, whose real name was Wallach, and Lev Kamenev, Rosenfeld, along with Mosai Uritsky, all of them Jewish. Lenin himself was of mostly Russian and Kalmuck ancestry, but he was also one-quarter Jewish. His maternal grandfather, Israel Alexander Blank, was a Ukrainian Jew who was later baptized into the Russian Orthodox Church. That pretty much says it, folks. They were all Jewish, including Lenin. A thoroughgoing internationalist, Lenin viewed ethnic or cultural loyalties with contempt. He had little regard for his own countrymen. An intelligent Russian, he once remarked, is almost always a Jew or someone with Jewish blood in his veins. So I guess that tells us where his sympathies lay. It's with the Jewish people, not the Russian people. And the only reason that Lenin was made the Prime Minister of Russia instead of Trotsky was that Trotsky refused to take the position, saying that, well, we have a Jewish president, we need to have a Christian or atheist at least in charge of being the premier. In the communist seizure of power in Russia, the Jewish role was probably critical. 2 weeks prior to the Judeo-Bolshevik October Revolution in 1917, Lenin convened a top-secret meeting in St. Petersburg, known as Petrograd, at which the key leaders of the Judeo-Bolshevik Party's Central Committee made the fateful decision to seize power in a violent takeover. Of the 12 persons who took part in this decisive gathering, There were four Russians, including Lenin, who was also 1/4 Jewish. One Georgian, Stalin, whose original name, Dushinsky, meant Little Jewison. One Pole, Dzerzhinsky, and six Jews. To direct the takeover, a 7-man political bureau was chosen. It consisted of two Russians, Lenin and Bubnov, one Georgian, Stalin, who was married to 3 Jewish women in his lifetime, 4 Jews, Trotsky, Sokolnikov, Zinoviev, and Kamenev. Meanwhile, the Petersburg or Petrograd Soviet, whose chairman was Trotsky, another Jew, established an 18-member military revolutionary committee to actually carry out the seizure of power. It included 8 or 9 Russians, 1 Ukrainian, 1 Pole, 1 Caucasian, and 6 Jews. Finally, to supervise the organization of the uprising, the Jewish Bolshevik Central Committee established a 5-man revolutionary military center as the party's operations command. It consisted of only 1 Russian, Bubnov, 1 Georgian, Stalin, 1 Pole, Dzerzhinsky, and 2 Jews, Sverdlov and Yuritsky. Well-informed observers, both inside and outside of Russia, took note at the time of the crucial Jewish role in Bolshevism, which is why it has always been called Judeo-Bolshevism. Winston Churchill, for one, warned in an article published in February 8th, 1920, the issue of the London Illustrated Sunday Herald, that Bolshevism is, quote, a wide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstitution of society on the basis of arrested development of envious malevolence and impossible equality, unquote. The eminent Jewish political leader and historian went on to write, there is no need to exaggerate the part played in the creation of Bolshevism and the actual bringing about of the Russian Revolution by these international and, for the most part, atheistical Jews. Now, this is Winston Churchill writing in a major newspaper in London. There is no need to exaggerate the part played in the creation of Bolshevism and in the actual bringing about of the Russian Revolution by these international and, for the most part, atheistical Jews. Now, don't blame me. Don't blame Frank Weltner for this. This was Winston Churchill, the most respected historian in the Western world in the 20th century. It's Churchill. Churchill said, it is certainly a very great one and probably outweighs all others. With the notable exception of Lenin, the majority of the leading figures were Jews. And of course, as we pointed out, Lenin spoke Yiddish, his family spoke Yiddish, and his grandfather was Jewish. And Lenin thought that the Jews were the only smart Russians around. Moreover, the principal inspiration and driving power comes from the Jewish leaders. Thus, Tichurin, a pure Russian, is eclipsed by his nominal subordinate Litvinov. The influence of Russians like Bukharin or Lunarsky cannot be compared with the power of Trotsky, who is Jewish, or of Jewish Zinoviev, the dictator of the Red Citadel, Petrograd, or of Krasin or Radek, all Jews. Again, these are the writings of Winston Churchill blaming the Jews on the Bolshevik Revolution. In the Soviet institutions, Churchill writes, the predominance of Jews is even more astonishing, and the prominent, if not indeed the principal part in the system of terrorism applied by the extraordinary commissions for combating counter-revolution, the Cheka, has been taken by Jews, and in some notable cases by Jewesses. These, ladies and gentlemen, are the writings of the great historian Winston Churchill, blaming the Jews soundly for Judeo-Bolshevism, for the takeover of Russia, and for the torture of these people, and of the control of the apparatus known as the Cheka, which was in charge of these great torture chambers. David R. Francis, United States Ambassador in Russia, warned in a January 1918 dispatch to Washington, quote, the Jewish Bolshevik leaders here, most of whom are Jews, and 90% of whom are returned exiles, many of them from New York City, like Trotsky, care little for Russia or any other country, but are Jewish internationalists, and they are trying to start a worldwide social revolution. The Netherlands ambassador in Russia, Oudendijk, made the same point a few months later, saying, "Unless Bolshevism is nipped in the bud immediately, it is bound to spread in one form or another over Europe and the whole world as it is organized and worked by Jews who have no nationality and whose one object is to destroy, for their own ends, the existing order of things." Unquote. The Bolshevik Revolution, declared a leading American Jewish community paper in 1920, quote, "was largely the product of Jewish thinking, Jewish discontent, Jewish effort to reconstruct," unquote. As an expression of its radically anti-nationalist character, the fledgling Soviet government issued a decree a few months after taking power that made anti-Semitism a crime in Russia. The new communist regime thus became the first in the world to severely punish all expressions of anti-Jewish sentiment. And of course, the reason they did this was that since the Jews ran the entire Soviet Union, any expression that was anti-Jewish was a veiled criticism of the Soviet Union itself. Soviet officials apparently regarded such measures as indispensable. Based on careful observation during a lengthy stay in Russia, American Jewish scholar Frank Golder reported in 1925 that because so many of the Soviet leaders are Jews, anti-Semitism is gaining in Russia, particularly in the army, and among the old and new intelligentsia who are being crowded for positions by the sons of Israel. In other words, the Jews got every position of importance, and the people in Russia were very resentful. And, of course, with all of the terror that was going on, they were extremely resentful. Like the terror that happened to Jew Watch News when I was attacked by Chertoff and by Mukasey, the heads of the Homeland Security Agency and the Department of Justice here in the so-called free United States of America, where my right to publish was guaranteed. And these people went after me with a vengeance because they were Jews. Well, so much for trusting Jewish people in America, and so much for trusting America as a free society. America is the American USSR now, run by the Jews of New York, the Goldman Sachs, the Banks of America, all of the banking giants who own the media, who own the government, who own the military, who own everything, literally, in this country that has any meaning, just as they did in the Soviet Union. Summing up the situation at that time, Israeli historian Louis Rappaport writes, "Immediately after the Bolshevik Revolution, many Jews were euphoric over their high representation in the new government. Lenin's first Politburo was dominated by men of Jewish origins. Under Lenin, Jews became involved in all aspects of the revolution, including its dirtiest work. Despite the communist vows to eradicate anti-Semitism, it spread rapidly after the revolution, partly because of the prominence of so many Jews in the Soviet administration, as well as the traumatic and human Sovietization drives that followed." Historian Salo Baron has noted that an immensely disproportionate number of Jews joined the new Bolshevik secret police, the Cheka, and many of those who fell afoul of the Cheka would be shot by none other than Jewish investigators. The collective leadership that emerged in Lenin's dying days was headed by the Jew Zinoviev, a loquacious, mean-spirited, curly-haired Adonis, whose vanity knew no bounds. "Anyone who had the misfortune to fall into the hands of the Cheka," wrote Jewish historian Leonard Shapiro, "stood a very good chance of finding himself confronted with and possibly shot by a Jewish investigator." In Ukraine, Jews made up nearly 5% of the rank-and-file Cheka agents, reports W. Bruce Lincoln, an American professor of Russian history. Beginning as the Cheka or Vechka, V-Cheka, the Soviet secret police was later known as the GPU, OGPU, NKVD, MVD, and KGB. In light of all of this, it should not be surprising that Yakov M. Yurovsky, the leader of the Bolshevik squad that carried out the murder of the Tsar and his family, was Jewish, as was Sverdlov, the Soviet chief who co-signed Lenin's executive order. Igor Shafarovich, a Russian mathematician of world stature, has sharply criticized the Jewish role in bringing down the Romanov monarchy and establishing communist rule in his country. Shafarovich was a leading dissident during the final decades of Soviet rule. A prominent human rights activist, he was a founding member of the Committee on the Defense of Human Rights in the USSR. In Russophobia, a book written 10 years before the collapse of communist rule, Shafarovich noted that Jews were amazingly numerous among the personnel of the Bolshevik secret police. The characteristic Jewishness of the Bolshevik executioner, Shafarovich went on, is most conspicuous in the execution of Nicholas II. This ritual action symbolized the end of centuries of Russian history, he wrote, so that it can be compared only to the execution of Charles I in England or Louis XVI in France. It would seem that the representatives of an insignificant ethnic minority should keep as far as possible from this painful action, which would reverberate in all history. Yet what names do we meet? The execution was personally overseen by the Jew Yakov Yurovsky, who shot the Tsar. The president of the local Soviet was the Jew Beloborodov Weisbart, the person responsible for the general administration at Ekaterinburg, was the Jew Shaya Golashikin. To round off the picture, on the wall of the room where the execution took place was a distich from a poem by Heine, written in German, about King Balthazar, who offended Jehovah and was killed for the offense, a poem written by a Jew. In his 1920 book, British veteran journalist Robert Wilton offered a similarly harsh assessment. The whole record of Bolshevism in Russia was indelibly impressed with the stamp of alien invasion. The murder of the Tsar, deliberately planned by the Jew Sverdlov, who came to Russia as a paid agent of Germany, and carried out by the Jews Golashekin, Semyonov, Safarov, Voykev, and Yurovsky, is the act not of the Russian people, but of this hostile Jewish invader. In the struggle for power that followed Lenin's death in 1924, Stalin, who was married to a Jew, emerged victorious over his rivals, eventually succeeding in putting to death nearly every one of the most prominent early Bolshevik leaders, including Trotsky, Zinoviev, Radek, and Kameniev. With the passage of time, and particularly after 1928, the Jewish role in the top leadership of the Soviet state and its Communist Party diminished markedly. But not markedly enough. Many of them escaped to America, which is now the new American USSR, and the process has started over again. You, my American friends, you are in danger. Your country is being run by IPAC, the descendants of the Judeo-Bolsheviks. These anti-democratic barbarians are within your gates. The moats are down. People are pouring into this country to take over. People from the Middle East, from China, from Africa, from South America. All of them people who are totally unlike you. Many Jewish people are coming here from Russia to live in Brighton Beach, New York, to dine on Russian soups and other vegetables, and to discuss and to laugh about how they took over the Soviet Union, and how they've now taken over the United States of America, and how stupid the Americans are for letting you in. This is what you're up against. You are the new Soviet Union, and your masters are the same Jews who murdered the Tsar and his children, and who murdered 65 million people in the Soviet Union. And most of the leaders came from New York, went back to Russia to do it, and now they're back in New York again. And you'd better be doing something about it. And soon.